You are listening to a sermon by Julie Canlis, recorded on Sunday, September 10th, 2023, at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Okay, well, I thought we should just get our bearings a little bit around Hebrews and just remind ourselves the context of who the letter was written to. And we're working with a bunch of Jewish converts to Jesus who live in Rome, which was the center, as you know, of the known world. It would be maybe like living in New York City or Vancouver, a pluralistic urban society, not too dissimilar from the giant cosmopolitan centers in Canada, America, other places around the world. In fact, the word city is mentioned more in the book of Hebrews than in any other book. And so this congregation, this fledgling congregation of primarily Jewish, not Gentile converts, they were struggling with this issue. If we are God's kids, then why is life so hard? And why are we being excluded? And why are we being looked down upon? Why are people mocking us, assaulting us, and no one is stepping in, you know, no one is stepping in to protect us here? Their stuff was getting stolen. The police weren't intervening. They were being dragged off to jail with no hearing, no trial. They were in the middle of a communal and personal crisis, which was a real challenge to their faith. And sometimes we don't feel like we're too far off from this. I know I'm not in a situation of persecution at all, but in some ways, I'll just give you like this tiny little window into my life. In some ways, my life feels like it's reaching a bit of a climax. You know, in the past few months, my kids have gotten into a bad car crash. We have been served a huge and scary lawsuit by a very difficult to love thy neighbor. Our marriage can feel stuck in some tender places since we now have our third child who's just gone off to college and we only have one more kid at home. So there's just lots of big transitions in our life personally here in Wenatchee, Washington. And sometimes I feel like when I read the book of Hebrews, I feel right there with the congregation and I feel like I need a refresher course on Jesus. So that's what the book of Hebrews was for those people. It was their refresher course on Jesus and who he was for them. And the metaphor that the preacher of Hebrews used to this troubled congregation is, I found it to be a really helpful one for me. It's that life is a journey or a pilgrimage. And it's a journey from weariness into rest. Life is a journey from alienation into the presence of God. Life is a journey from isolation into the city of God. And the only way you're going to get to the end of the journey, the only way you're going to get home is through fixing your eyes on, in a very sustained long-term way, on Jesus. This is the marathon, not a sprint stuff. This is the Eugene Peterson book title, A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. That's kind of the spirituality of this book of Hebrews. And so we arrive at the beginning of chapter 8. So for seven chapters, he's been preaching and walking in them through all these arguments. And finally, at the very beginning of chapter 8, he says, we are now at my main point. And he says, the main point of what we are saying is this: we do have such a high priest. And this is where I want to start. I want to give us a little bit of background to Hebrews. How do we, living in the 21st century, connect to this idea of Jesus as a high priest for us? What does this mean for us today? What did it mean to them 2,000 years ago? And what is this role of priest that Jesus is taking on? Because this language, through some of my research, I've just been deeply encouraged, and my imagination around this language of high priest has been invigorated. So that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. And this is I'll return to this picture later, but this is a wonderful picture of Moses and Aaron. So you've got Moses on the left representing the law. You've got Aaron on the right representing the priesthood. So we're going to take a quick tour of religions around the world and just set ourselves in the context of priests and temples back then. So the main, here's Hebrews 8. Now, the main point of what we are saying is that we do have such a high priest who sat down. So today I'm going to be looking at what does it mean that we have a high priest? And next week I'm going to start we're going to start with who sat down. What does it mean that this priest sat down? What does that mean for us today? We're going to take a quick look at religions around the world. And in many early religions, what would happen on a daily basis in the temples with the priesthood? For many religions, creation is reenacted in the temple on a daily basis, and the maintaining of the world depended on what the priests would do in the temple. It was the priest's job to keep the gods fed and watered in the temple, and thus the land would produce food and rain. And it was the priest's job to wake up the gods in the morning, to tuck them into bed at night with their prayers, thus ensuring that the sun would rise and set. And this was so that everyone would have good fortune and the land would have blessing. Here's a wonderful image from Egypt. You can see that the high priest is holding the whole priesthood, and the priesthood is then ensuring that the beetle god, who's responsible for the sun, you know, is at his work. Here's another one from Egypt. This is, I think, the goddess Nut, and she's the one who would swallow the sun every night, and everything would go dark, and then she would give birth to the sun in the morning. And you can see the whole priesthood riding on her back, going around her. So basically, this whole rising and setting of the sun is dependent on the priests caring for this goddess, whose responsibility is to keep the sun going by day and to put the sun to bed at night. Here's a little bit from Babylon, a cuneiform tablet, mapping out the priest's responsibilities and how it was related to creation and the maintaining of creation. So what does this all have to do with Hebrews and high priests? Well, the temple itself would communicate theology. The temple, the Hebrew temple, the Israelite temple, communicated our place in the world, God's place, and how the relationship to the world is maintained. So we saw this in Egypt. And so our question moving forward is, what is this relationship between the priests and creation? So if we just remember Genesis, we know that this is a creation story, which is similar to and also has differences from all these other stories in the ancient Near East. But one of the big similarities that I've been fascinated by is the significance of the 6 days. In, you know, if you were a Hebrew listener to this tale of creation, you would know exactly what was happening, because 6 days, you know, the creation was happening in 6 days. All temple stories happened in 6 days. 6 days meant the creation of the temple. And so the author of Genesis is hinting at, with innuendo and all the literary metaphors of his day, that when God is creating the earth, this is also his temple. Temples take 6 days. The earth took 6 days. The earth is God's temple. So God's sacred space is not something set apart from us, but God's sacred space is all of life. Everywhere you go, you're part of God's temple. So you find the author of Genesis refusing to delineate between the sacred and the secular. All ordinary existence is sacred. God dwells here. God is not splitting the world into different classes of people or into the sacred and secular. Instead, God is splitting things, but he's splitting light and darkness, water from water, but not sacred from secular. And he's doing all of this to make room for his child. And so this is a holy world full of love, and the Spirit is hovering over it all. So if we fast forward to Exodus and Moses, and the people of God now being liberated from Egypt, Moses is now given very specific instructions for the tabernacle. But also, if you're a Hebrew listener, if you're saturated in this language, you pick up immediately that the instructions for the temple or the tabernacle is, again, using creation language. Any Jewish person listening would hear, oh, we're back in creation language again, because the priests are told to till and keep the tabernacle, just as Adam and Eve are told to till and keep the garden. And just as you have the Spirit hovering over the waters in Exodus, you have the Spirit hovering over the tabernacle artists. So again, there's all this connection between the tabernacle and creation. And so we're kind of in this ancient Near Eastern connection between creation and what's happening in the tabernacle. Okay, I'm nearly there for making these connections to the book of Hebrews. But what I want us to really grab onto is this deep interconnectedness between creation and temple. But when we get to Genesis and sin, when sin came, all of this begins to be ruptured. And suddenly we have a need for priests who would deal with the sin problem. Priests are not just dealing with the maintaining. Adam and Eve were the first priests. They were the early priests maintaining creation for us. But now the priests have to have a new role of not just maintaining creation, but dealing with sin. And this is where we get into some of those strange Old Testament purity laws. And we sometimes wonder, why is there such a strange, complex system of purity laws? And, oh, sorry, here's my wonderful image of creation. This is from an Orthodox iconographer. But here's God's creation where he's splitting, but he's not splitting sacred and secular. He's not splitting classes of people. He's splitting light and darkness. But we get to the Old Testament purity laws, and we suddenly see this radical ministry of the priests, which is separation. The priests are controlling who is in and who is out, who is clean, who is unclean. You know, we can't eat sausage. We can't have clam chowder. Israel is now separated from all the other nations as a holy people. And they now serve the metaphorical function of being separate and as a sign to the other nations. So listen to Leviticus 20 here. And listen to all this separation language in Leviticus 20. I am the Lord your God, who separated you from the peoples. You shall therefore make a distinction between the clean beast and the unclean, between the clean bird and the unclean. You shall not make yourself abominable by beast or bird or anything unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples so that you should be mine. Okay, so with the advent of sin, now the whole Jewish nation has to be pulled out from other peoples to show them God's character. So the temple now is a new way of maintaining creation, but creation is now maintained through division. And there are, of course, the Genesis 1 divisions, light and darkness, but this is now applied to people. There are clean and unclean people. It's applied to animals, clean and unclean animals. And now there's even social separation starting: Jew, Gentile, male, female, ordinary person, and the priesthood, master, servant. So this is now what's happening with this ministry of separation and division. I just had to let you know that, yes, that would be truly unclean and unacceptable if you were living, sadly, if you were living in that era. So now the Israelite priests of the tribe of Levi, they're not just tilling and gardening the garden temple anymore. They are fighting the waters of chaos and death in their sacrificial liturgy. They are now taking part in how the world is sustained and purified. And the priests at every turn are reminding people about clean and unclean and life and death. They're reminding people that the creation project has gone off course, and it's up to the temple to try and reflect this new order of the universe. Sometimes I've wondered, as my kids have read through Leviticus and asked me about all these crazy purity laws, why, Mom? This just seems so weird. Couldn't God have done it a different way? Maybe, but here's something important for us to understand. And this is a wonderful thing I learned from Calvin. God speaks our language. God enters into how the people of the ancient Near East saw the world and how they understood it. And Calvin calls this God speaking baby talk. God is entering into all these rituals, and he's doing this because he's speaking their language of religion. This is his baby talk for them. He's speaking how we can understand. So in all of this sacrificial system, with all of these divisions and clean and unclean and purification rites, God is saying, I'm speaking your language. I'm real. I'm here. I'm a continued presence to you. Let's establish a tent so you can see that I'm really here. I'll be present in such a physical way that you cannot misunderstand my presence. I'll be a cloud of glory that will come over you. I will settle on this nomadic animal skin tent because that's all you can carry on your backs right now. So that's what our tabernacle is going to be. And through this, a whole religious system is being created that will testify to God's transcendent presence at the heart of all things. And this even is acknowledging the sin gap by having things that are clean and unclean. There's a witness to the fact that there is sin and a need for us to be cleansed. So as Calvin would say, this is a phase of baby talk, but the whole point of baby talk is God acknowledging you are my children. I love speaking baby talk with you. It's imperfect. It will pass away. And I can't wait until I can really show you my forgiving presence, but this is good enough for now. It's not wrong, but it's not complete. So again, the sacrificial system, as much as it seems foreign to us, and even to my kids, it feels like, I wish that wasn't in the Bible. I keep trying to convince them, no, this is God's gentleness with where the Israelite nation was at the time. It's baby talk. They weren't ready for the reality yet. And the Jewish religious system was not wrong. It's not bad, but it was incomplete. It was getting them ready for something where God wanted to reveal even more of his fullness. I just think this is interesting. This is a Jewish mikveh that has just been excavated in Israel, their ritual bath that was a foreshadow of baptism. So this is cleansing that God is initiating and instantiating for them, but a better cleansing is coming. So this light and dark, impure and pure consciousness permeated early Israelite spirituality. And this is a common prayer from the time of Jesus. Jesus may have even said this, who knows? Blessed is he who distinguishes between holy and profane, light and darkness, Israelite and Gentile, the 6 days and the Sabbath, the waters above from the waters below, the priests from the regular Israelite. And this prayer was spoken by both the priestly class and the normal class. And again, the priest's role here is to maintain creation by dividing it, by separating, by keeping darkness at bay, sickness at bay, decay at bay, death at bay. Again, you know, leprosy was a big threat at the time. So let no leper, let nothing unclean come near. And so priests had to be pure. They had to be set apart in order to help continue the whole order and to represent God's holiness and his transcendence. So the priests were there to divide good from evil and to check for sores. They had to check for sickness. They had to witness if someone had been healed and declare them clean. And they also would keep all the unclean things outside the camp. They were there to testify that something had gone wrong and that we needed to keep the things that were wrong at a far distance from us. And because God is always associated with life, death in particular was seen as taboo. Anyone who was sick or dead bodies were always kept outside the camp. Anything or anyone that was deformed had to be kept outside the camp. Imperfection happened outside the camp. And the goal was maximal distance between life and death. And the most impure object of all was the corpse. Even the high priest was not able to mourn his closest family member, lest they would make him unclean. He must be perfect in any way, untouched by sickness, death, and deformity. And there is this very bizarre story of an ambitious and probably unholy priest named Antigonus, who wanted to be the high priest during the Roman occupation, but his uncle was the high priest. So he had to figure out a way, how could he disqualify his uncle from being high priest? He couldn't kill him, but he had to disqualify him. And so the way that he realized that he could disqualify his uncle was to deform him. And so he bit off his uncle's ear. And so that made his uncle unfit for the priesthood, and Antigonus assumed the place of high priest. So what's interesting is he wasn't disqualified by maiming his uncle. His uncle was disqualified by being maimed. And so you see the way that this system, even though it's testifying to something, this is obviously a system with great shortcomings as well. It's only so good. It speaks to a primitive people's sense of purity, death and life, uncleanness and cleanness, and the need for a way to be clean. But Jesus comes to show us a better way. So now we enter into Hebrews, and where Jesus is given this label of priest. And what is the author of Hebrews saying to us when he identifies Jesus as our priest? Well, first of all, we're right smack dab in the middle of creation language. The very opening three verses of Hebrews 1 says, in many ways, God spoke to our fathers, but in the last days, he has spoken to us through his son, whom he appointed heir, and through whom he created the world. So here Hebrews is beginning, just like Genesis, with speaking, and speaking is how God creates. And then Hebrews 1:3 closes by saying, he upholds the universe by his word of power. So first of all, when Jesus is named priest, we're back right back into creation language. The priest is the one who's maintaining creation. But here's the amazing thing, and this is what Hebrews is trying to point out, that Jesus' priesthood accomplishes God's real intent beyond the intent of separating and dividing. Instead of maintaining creation through division, instead of witnessing to the gap between pure and impure, Jesus stops separating things and he enters into them. So we have the first creation here where it says he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And then we have the new creation being testified to when it says in Hebrews, when he had made purification for sins. So again, we have the first creation. Everything unclean is kept outside of the camp. And then, so here's the creation language. First creation, he's upholding the universe by his word of power. But now also as the priest, the high priest, he is establishing the new creation through purification for sins. And so we now have this high priest who dies outside the camp to purify everything and everyone. So instead of keeping the unclean things outside the camp, Jesus dies outside the camp so that we can be made clean. And so Jesus's priesthood is not about separation, but about solidarity. And his qualification for this high priest, it's not physical perfection. It's not that his ear wasn't maimed. It's not that he had bodily perfection. Hebrews 2 tells us what are his qualifications for being high priest. It says, since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself partook of the same nature, that through death he might destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to bondage. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest to make expiation for the sins of the people. Going back for a second. So here's the original high priest keeping things outside the camp, the first high priesthood maintained and witnessed to God's purity. And Jesus is the high priest who goes outside the camp where everything unclean is. He becomes a corpse outside of camp. And from this place outside begins the new creation. So he establishes, he puts his flag, you know, of the new creation outside the camp in the impurest place and said, this is where the new creation is going to begin. And so we have this new high priest who no longer separates things out in the old way. And in this new high priest, God is changing his relationship to pain and evil and suffering and death. Jesus, the creator, is now upholding the universe through pain, through suffering, through evil, and through death. God is setting up shop outside the camp. And everything the old priests tried to protect us from and separate us from become the ways that Jesus is continuing the new creation project forward. And he's carrying you and me, and he's bearing us and all the world forward by death and sacrifice and destruction. And this is why I do love that song, that line from the song you're going to hear at the end, which is, he says, you never change, yet you change everything. So God isn't changing in Jesus, but he's changing his relationship to evil and death. He's subverting the old order of things as he'd been intending and hinting through the prophets all along. So God in Christ doesn't try and maintain the old sacrificial system, which testified to his holiness. He still is holy. He does not change, but he's testifying to his holiness in a new radical way. This is the new creativeness of God. This is how creative he is. In Jesus, we have the beginnings of a new creation with a new creative high priest at its head. One way that I keep having this being brought home to us as a congregation personally, we've just purchased a 100-year-old church building from an absolutely incredible congregation, and they are now kind of joining our church congregation. But the remodel, I mean, some people have said, can we just take down the church and start over? Because it is so, we've got light switches that turn on the lights, for lights 50 feet away. The old furnace system is so outdated and broken. We've got an elevator in the wrong place, which is, causing traffic flow, and to move the elevator is thousands and thousands of dollars. We've got dry rot. We've got, plumbing problems. We've got pigeons in the turrets. But I just keep thinking, no. This is God. This is what God works with. It's easier to start over and to take down the whole building and get something nice and crisp and new. But that's what God refused to do in Christ. This is the grand remodel where he takes and he works with all of these idiosyncrasies and begins his new creation in this place. So this is we are God's most creative act. We are the place where the new creation is forming. And this will no longer work. The new creation doesn't spring out of opposites in separating light and dark and pure and impure and male and female and priesthood from the laity. But this new creation is by Jesus entering into these things and in solidarity with these things. So he stops separating things and he enters into solidarity with them. So our new theology of creation centers on a corpse and centers on it being raised from the dead. And this is God's ultimate creative act. And through his priesthood, he doesn't detach himself from us or from women or from Gentiles, but he joins himself to all of us. And I just think about what would have meant to these Jewish Christians in Rome, urban Christians facing increasingly difficult circumstances. Their next generation after them would all be persecuted in multiple terrible rounds. And I just think about what would this message be for them? They had to look around them at the raw materials of their life right now, at their suffering, their trauma, their persecution, their exhaustion, and they had to know that their new high priest was working with these things to bring forth the new creation. Take heart, says the author of Hebrews. Our priest is creating anew with these things. He's remaking and rebuilding with precisely these difficult things. So God uses often, I mean, when we look back over our stories, we often find that God uses the very things that we are ashamed of. And he takes our past and redeems it. He doesn't cut it off and give us a new slate. Because as Eugene Peterson would always say to us, Rosie, you might remember this, but he would always say, God's way is growth, not change. It's growth. It's growth. It's growth. So I think I've been challenged by needing my ideas of priesthood to be realigned with Jesus as the high priest. And I think that for many years, my understanding of priesthood had been defined more by Aaron than by Jesus. And I need to have my understanding of priesthood defined by Christ on the cross, outside of the camp, in solidarity with everything impure. And this is why Hebrews says Jesus is not in the order of Aaron, but he's in the order of Melchizedek. Hebrews 5 is saying, we have a priest on our hands here, but we need to let him redefine our notion of what it is that priests do. So in closing, I just made us a short list of the maybe my old associations with the Aaronic priesthood, and then the new challenging associations of Jesus needing to redefine our notion of priesthood. So with Aaron, we have separation, and Jesus, Melchizedek, we have solidarity as the mark of a priest. With Aaron, the creation happens only out of the purest things, the whitest animals. With Jesus, there's chaos, there's evil and suffering, and that's where the new creation is beginning. With Aaron, corpses were the most contaminating elements. And with Melchizedek or Jesus, the corpse becomes the most holy of holies. And so, with an Aaronic understanding of priesthood and purification, we have to remove ourselves from chaos and impurity. And Jesus provides a way for us to draw near to it. And I think about this in terms of my own life. Am I entering into my story deeply, the story of my neighbors. Am I being part of the new creation that is happening in unexpected places all around me? Or am I trying to remove myself and make something clean and safe and familiar that I can retreat to for my own sense of purity? Or am I looking to Jesus to actually create something better out of the things that are most difficult in my life? Am I trying to distance myself from those things and those people, or am I looking for the new creation that can bubble up out of that place? I even think about the Eucharist, when the Eucharist is not saying you can't come forward unless you're holy. The Eucharist is weekly testifying to this, that what are we doing? We're offering to God the very worst thing on a Sunday. We're offering him his own death. We're offering to him our murder of him. And every time we're walking forward in the faith and the hope that he will make something new out of death. So every time we take communion, we are saying, we're asking God, make life out of death again. Make beauty out of my ugliness that I can offer to you. And so maybe for this week, as we just think about Jesus as being our high priest, we can perhaps wonder, can I see my past or my fears differently? Can the new creation happen in the worst things that are happening to me right now? What if God's new creation happened in the biggest failure of all, the cross? That is where the new creation begins. And so I'm an Enneagram 7. I don't know if that language means anything to you guys, but suffering is not what I love doing. But Hebrews is reminding me, no, Julie, suffering is where I plant my flag. This is where I can make things new for you. I don't have to embrace my suffering in a masochistic way, but neither do I have to avoid it. I can welcome it and what new thing God wants to make in me through some of these difficult circumstances in my life right now. This is the upside down kingdom that we are invited to enter every day.